Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello there, welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnar Blog. Hello to you, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Recording a little later than usual, but I think we probably needed the time to digest and prepare ourselves for this.
Yeah, I mean, that's not why we're recording later, but...
No, it's because I was driving a car back from Wales, but, you know... We've got to grasp at straws here.
Yeah, I think straws are the only thing that we've got left to grasp. I don't even know where to fucking start.
No.
You know, normally when we do the podcast, I sort of have a clear idea of how things are going to go and what we're going to talk about and how we're going to talk about it and what structure it might take. You know, that's not to say we do an awful lot of planning other than sort of say, hello, let's start recording. But, you know, you just have it in your head that... this is the way it's going to go. And today, I'm really not sure what we can say that we haven't already said. I'm not sure what we can analyze that we haven't already analyzed. And, it feels like a weird one. So we'll just have to wait and see where it takes us.
I mean, maybe we'll get to an argument about jam and that will fill the next hour somehow. I don't know. It's really difficult today. It's difficult because... But by the same token, I can't actually say I feel particularly surprised. I mean, has this caught you off guard at all? I kind of, even though we had the little upturn, I always felt like this was a game that wasn't going to end prettily for Arsenal.
No, not terribly surprised. I was a little more hopeful going into it than I would have been. You know, after the FA Cup game, I thought, well, okay, you know, there's something there. There's something still there after the FA Cup game. And then... you know, I could see when we played Leicester in midweek, you're going, well, look, we did just play 120 minutes against Manchester City, playing against a team that hadn't played a game, and they were just interested in defending. It wasn't a great performance. We got lucky with the goal, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, yeah.
There's a good plane going over.
Yeah.
the plane of doom.
Hang on, let me just have a look. It's there is a Wengerin banner draping out the back of it. I wonder who's flying that.
But I think we did say, didn't we, that, you know, in order to say that we've really turned the corner, we had to do it in these other games, these final seven fixtures that we have remaining in the Premier League, or six or seven that we had at that point. And Tottenham was always going to be... the real test, I think. You know, there was something interesting that Arsene Wenger said last week after the Man City game. He said that, you know, if you're doing poorly in one competition, another competition sort of feels like an escape from you know, the mundanity of the league football, or you're in such a position in the league that no matter how hard you try, you can't see a way out. But at least a cup game gives you a fresh focus, and I think it's clear that was the case with the Manchester City game.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that he's using that language, because that's kind of the same way he talked about the new formation, isn't it? It's like something different, something to shift your focus. And I think in there is a kind of tacit admission that our season, and our league season particularly, is kind of entrenched in this grim situation. And really, we're looking for things to dig us out of it, but... we are really in the mire. And, you know, the Middlesbrough and the Leicester wins, and obviously the City game, were some welcome respite. But I I guess what happened at White Hart Lane was a bit of a reality check. I mean, I'm looking at the league table now. I'm seeing Tottenham in second. I'm seeing Arsenal in sixth. I'm seeing a gap of 14 points.
No, you're really, not. No, you're not. You're seeing a gap of 17 points.
Oh, let me refresh the page. Yeah, sorry, that's a page from yesterday. So, I wish it was still true. But, like, we've seen big gaps between us and Spurs in the past, but never at this stage of the season, never with so little time left, you know. And obviously, it cemented what we knew was coming, that they're going to finish above us, but not just above us, well clear of us. And I thought the gulf between the two teams, and I know that sounds dramatic to talk about it like that, but the gulf between the two teams was evident yesterday during that game.
It really was. They were by far the better team. They were much more organized. They knew what they wanted to do. They knew how they wanted to do it and how they could execute the various things that they wanted to execute. Whereas we, whenever we got the ball, you know, I was looking at an Arsenal side who couldn't keep the ball. And that's extraordinary for Arsenal. Maybe not when we're playing really good opposition anymore, but you do feel like we really struggle to know what it is we're supposed to be doing and how it is we're supposed to be doing it. The team looks disjointed. It looks like it doesn't quite understand the system it's supposed to be playing. And, you know, it's very difficult, isn't it, to look at a Tottenham side like that and compare it to us and the way that we played. You know, I don't even know what to say.
Without wanting to kill yourself. No, you know, they do in the derby games, they do always do a kind of combined 11 thing.
Ugh.
And yeah, I mean, obviously they are awful, but this year particularly, I was sort of seeing that slew of articles come out about the combined 11. And I was thinking, never has that article felt less relevant, because when you know, at the end of the game, Jamie Redknapp says, well, you know, if you ask Mauricio Pochettino how many of those Arsenal players he'd want in his team, how many would he say? One or two? I think that is completely missing the point at this stage. Like, I look at those two 11s and I genuinely think that Arsenal have got probably more talented players than Spurs.
Yeah.
On balance. I think the idea that this is about the quality of the players and their talent is complete nonsense. And I think putting those combined 11s together and saying, oh, well, you know, Arsenal players wouldn't get in. They would. If they had that coach, they probably, you know, it would be, if you put those two squads together, it'd be predominantly Arsenal players. I really, really believe that. You know, I was doing player ratings yesterday for ESPN. I know you do player ratings for Ask Blog News. I don't know how you felt about it, but I felt like this feels mental now. Like, talking about individual player performances almost feels
redundant.
Absurd.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I know we're doing ourselves out of a good deal of content because we're going to have to fill the podcast and talk about players, but it's not about that anymore, is it?
No, because you look at what this team looked like until, was it December? You know, they'd beaten Chelsea 3-0. They weren't necessarily that convincing against Manchester United away. Didn't have a great North London derby at the Emirates. But, you know, they'd been unbeaten for 19 games. And there was, I think, some genuine belief that this was a group of players who could go and do something. Because we looked at the squad and looked at the players, player for player. You look at it in each position, you think, have we got backup there? Have we got enough centre-halves? Have we got enough midfielders? Is there enough to fill those front three positions? And the way that this season has essentially gone off a cliff, it cannot be because one or two players aren't playing as well as they should, or because we need something a bit different in midfield. And I don't dispute that we could do with something a bit different in midfield, but I don't think that's the general point. It's the fact that there's been a collective malaise that has set in and taken hold of this group of players that either they or the manager seem completely unable to get them out of. We have won 6 of our last 16 games, and 2 of those games were against non-league opposition.
I mean, that really does speak for itself, but obviously that's looking at the relatively recent results. If you look back at our fixtures away to teams in the top 6 over the last 2 years, it's a terrible record. I mean, I don't have the stats to have, but I don't think we've won a league fixture like that in, what, 2 years, is it? Something like that?
Actually, I'm pretty sure I had a question about that. Let me see if I can find it here. I know we're not doing the questions part yet, but Adam Arsenal says, we haven't won an away game versus the current top six in 2 years. That's extraordinary.
Mm.
That really is extraordinary.
Well, it's extraordinary for a club who are in that top six. Do you know what I mean? And,
sure.
And that's the fear, that we're being pushed out, really, because we can't, we're not competing in these games regularly enough.
Mm. You look at a North London derby as a game in which form goes out the window. We've said that plenty of times, and that's true to an extent. But I think yesterday was one where form was in the window. I don't know how you would describe it, but the very least you want from Arsenal players is to work hard for each other, to try and get something from a game. And to me, it looked like too many players were playing for themselves yesterday. There wasn't enough team focus on the way that we played. When players got the ball, they were looking to do things with it. There was one moment where I think Giroud had it down the left-hand side. We'd worked the ball down the left-hand side. And maybe he was expecting a runner. Maybe he was expecting somebody to back him up in that position. He just played a ball infield, blind, didn't look to see who was there, and it just went straight to a Tottenham player. You look at the statistics that Gibbs, Oxlade-Chamberlain and Alexis Sanchez lost possession 20 times each. I mean, what is that?
I know.
It's not because these players are so unbelievably shit that they can't pass the ball to another Arsenal player. And it's not as if it's just because it's Tottenham or how good Tottenham were yesterday or how hard they worked. That's a factor, of course. But we've played this badly against other sides. You know, you look at what we did against Crystal Palace and what we did against West Brom. And you're asking, well, what on earth is happening or not happening? And what the fuck is anyone going to do about it?
Do you think it's particularly discouraging having had the sort of fillip of the City game and feeling like there was a chance there for us to turn things around a little bit? Do you think that makes what happened at White Hart Lane more painful?
A little bit, because, you know, Arsene Wenger was talking about how he, before the game, it was one of those things that, like, he tends to do these stories about, there was one before West Brom, we've got to be careful from set pieces against West Brom, he says, before the game, and then we concede two of the stupidest corners you ever see. And then he talked about how the strength, the mental strength and character of his players was extraordinary before this game, because, you know, they've been through a difficult period and they found it hard to get themselves out of it. And now, with three wins and reaching an FA Cup final, they've come through the other side. And then you look at them and you think, what are you seeing? What are you seeing that none of us are, or very few of us are seeing when those players go out on the pitch?
Well, something he does say publicly quite regularly is, believe me, I watch these players every day in training. I cannot question their mentality. But Arsene Wenger knows as well as anybody that you don't get any points for training. You know, like, that's one. There are plenty of players who are brilliant in training, don't deliver on the pitch. It's a known phenomenon within football. And it must be the case, if we trust Arsene Wenger's judgment, that we've got plenty of those at London Colney.
Do we trust his judgment, though? That's the thing. I mean, how can you marry those things? How can you talk about the extraordinary character of your players when they go out in a North London derby? And I won't say, you know, I'm not going to get into stuff like desire and fight and wanting it and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, what you can see a team that's working hard together, and that was Tottenham yesterday. You could see it. You could see the way that they set themselves up, the little tactical switch at halftime to move Son over to the other side to run at Kieran Gibbs and to, you know, see what Alexis go with him. He had a lot of joy down the left-hand side in the first half. You know, those are players who were switched on. Absolutely switched on. The Dele Alli goal is a perfect example of that. You know, soft defending. Christian Eriksen dances between a couple of players. And, you know, when Petacek made that save, he had every right to expect one of his defenders to be, like, laser focused on that ball and making sure that they got there before whichever Tottenham player was lurking around. But Kieran Gibbs was standing watching. I can't remember who else was in the vicinity, but nobody was nobody was there quickly enough. Mm. And it's those like 2 or 3% that make the difference in games. And we're found wanting again.
Yeah, of course. I know it's frustrating for some people to talk about abstract qualities like desire and belief and things like that. But I think something that's not abstract and that has a practical application is belief in a plan.
Mm.
And I just feel like Arsenal players look as if they don't believe in the plan. They're not committed to a strategy. Mm. And, I mean, of course, that always is going to come back on the manager.
Mm.
So, you know, either that's not in place, or if it is, they're not listening, or they don't share his conviction about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
speaking of plans, what did you make of the lineup? There were a couple of surprises in there for me straight away.
Yeah, I was really surprised that. I wasn't necessarily surprised because I don't believe that Arsene Wenger really believes in three at the back. I don't think you play for 21 years at a club with a back four. The minute he took over at Arsenal, basically he changed from a back three to a back four. He's played that system his entire life. This football club, I don't believe that he thinks three at the back is anything other than a last gasp, desperate attempt to refocus his players somehow. And maybe, you know, it worked at Wembley, and full credit to that, it worked. But I don't think he's serious about the implementation of it, because if he were, he would not have dropped Rob Holding against Leicester. Absolutely not. He would have kept him in the team. And if he deems Rob Holding good enough to play against Manchester City in an FA Cup semi-final. I know there were injuries involved, but Rob Holding was one of our best players at Wembley.
I completely agree.
And
I mean, Kieran Gibbs wasn't so outstanding against Leicester that, you know, he demanded inclusion at White Hart Lane. I was really surprised and disappointed. I thought maybe there was some justification for leaving Holding out Leicester because, you know, he's a young player. Wenger wanted to keep him fresh for the Spurs game, in my mind.
Sure.
When he was then left out of that match, I was, you know, flabbergasted.
But, I mean, he's hardly played. He hasn't played. He's a young guy. He's 21 years of age. He can play three games a week. He's only made 12 or 15 appearances. So, you know, I just don't see why, when you, in classic Arsene Wenger style, you stumble across something that works. Like that back three did at Wembley. Gabriel was excellent. Koscielny was very good. Holding was superb. Oxlade-Chamberlain on the right. Monreal on the left. You know, that was the platform for winning that game. It fucking worked. So why do you change it?
Yeah.
Why fucking fuck around with it? Because why? Because you want to prove that you can do it a different way? Or because, you know, I don't know, maybe he wasn't convinced himself? But there's no reason why Kieran Gibbs, and it's not a slight on Kieran Gibbs, starting a consecutive league games for the first time in 2 years. Like, if anybody
story.
It really does tell its own story about, you know, where he is in the squad and how he's viewed. And, you know, he doesn't play a left back because Arsene Wenger thinks Nacho Monreal is a better left back. Simple as that. There's no other reason. It's because Gibbs is deemed inferior to Monreal. But if you're serious about playing three at the back, you keep Holding in that side. You don't fuck him around by leaving him out of the game against Leicester, and you don't, fuck the team around by leaving him out of a game against Tottenham, a game that we just could not afford to lose. And that back five, you know, we talk about a back three, but in reality it's sort of a back five, isn't it? When the wingbacks slot in, it was not as effective as it should have been, because I think Monreal is better going forward than Kieran Gibbs. He links better with Alexis. I think Holding would have been a better centre half, better at centre half. You know, I didn't really understand that. I didn't understand it, and I was a bit disappointed as well to see Olivier Giroud start up front.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if Spurs have a weakness or an area to exploit, it is the space in behind. And in playing Giroud there, you effectively guarantee that won't happen. I found that a really, really strange one. I thought, again, when Danny Welbeck didn't start against Leicester, I had it in my mind that, well, it's to keep him fresh and ready for White Hart Lane. So, really, I mean, we know Arsene Wenger has enormous faith in Olivier Giroud, but I couldn't for the life of me understand that decision.
Well, yeah, you know, again, you know, it's not really about Giroud, is it? Because he's not picking the team. It's
no.
It's the impact that a player like that has on the way that the team plays. And if you want to play fast, dynamic football, then you can't do it really with Olivier Giroud on the side. You just can't do it. And if for example we started Danny Welbeck and we were 2-0 down, and then you're calling on Olivier Giroud to come on from the bench, I'd be a lot more confident that he could make an impact there.
Yeah, of course.
Well,
and there are so many players I would have started ahead of Giroud in that game. I would have rather seen Welbeck start. I would have rather seen Iwobi start and play Alexis up top.
Yeah,
I would rather have seen Elneny start alongside Xhaka and play Ramsey in a more advanced role. I didn't think it was a game for Giroud, and it proved to be the case, didn't it? I mean, obviously he wasn't helped with masses of service, but I mean, he barely got a kick. He wasn't in the game.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, if you're a centre forward and you're not getting any service, you can still impose yourself on the game in a way. He did a little bit of pressing, a little bit of closing down, but there was a moment where in the start of the second half where he moved to close down a player in our half, and it was striking that he did that. It was like, oh God, he's moving, you know? And then he sort of slotted back into the center forward role where he sort of ambles between the two center halves and ambles left and ambles right, you know, as they move the ball around the back and, you know, just taking up that classic center forward position. But like, what the fuck good is that to anybody? Especially in a game where it was obvious from the first half that we were lucky to go in 0-0. And they were playing an
very
awful
lucky.
Lot better.
I mean, it
than
should
we
have been
were.
2-0, shouldn't it?
Oh Jesus!
That's
one of the misses of the season from Dele Alli, and also from Eriksen, a player of his quality, putting it over the bar from that distance. I mean, we got away with it. We got away with it, and
we did.
The warning signs
I
were
mean,
there.
God knows exactly. I mean, 2-0. I think the reason 2-0 is not in itself a terrible, terrible result, but I think the reason Arsenal fans feel as guided as they do is I think everyone watching that game knows it could well have been significantly more.
Mm, thanks to Petr Cech. If it wasn't for Petr Cech, then it would have been
absolutely.
More. He had a brilliant game. I mean, he made some incredible saves, some really great saves. Mm. I suppose, isn't it just in some ways, doesn't it sum up our season where Petr Cech has his best game for probably in an Arsenal shirt, and it comes in a game where we lose to Tottenham in the game that sees Tottenham finish above us for the first time in 21 years, a game in which we could have put a real dent in their title hopes. Instead, we allowed them to keep that thing going.
To borrow an Arsenal phrase, that sums it all up, really.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's... Yeah, I mean, at half-time, I was kind of thinking, well, look, I mean, 0-0 at half-time...
I was happy.
I would have... Yeah. I mean, I would have snapped your hand off with that, because this was a game where, to be honest, a point would have been very welcome in my eyes.
Mm. But then, of course, there was the second half and the Dele Alli goal and then the penalty. Any doubts in your mind about the penalty?
Well, look, there's no doubt in my mind about what Harry Kane is doing. He's swinging that leg out and letting it catch Gabriel. But you can't go to ground like that, can you, in the penalty box? It's just too reckless.
Well, he didn't go to ground. What he did was he just took a kick. He took a swipe at Kane's leg as Kane pushed the ball past him. And you can see, you know, what he was trying to do, the way he was going to do it. It was daft defending. You know, Kane definitely made the most of it. There's no question about that. The way that he sort of hung out his leg and made more contact with Gabriel. It's like, it's a weekend of diving extravaganzas from, in the Premier League, in some of the big games. But really, if you kick, Rashford's was awful. Like, who gives a fuck about that? you can't take a swipe at a forward like that and not expect to get punished for it, because 99% of the time the referee is going to give a penalty, particularly as all the strikers in the Premier League are going to make the most of that contact. Like, you think Olivier Giroud wouldn't, or Harry Kane or Alexis Sanchez wouldn't if it happened on him? Of course they would. So, you know, to concede two goals in whatever it was, 2 minutes, you're like, for fuck's sake.
I mean, that's, you know, that's Arsenal to a T, isn't it? They go a goal down, and that's when they're so psychologically vulnerable at times, you know, that it just feels like it's going to collapse. I mean, and as we said a minute ago, if it were not for Cech, from that point on, it could have been a drubbing, a real drubbing.
Mm. What did you make of the decision to take Granit Xhaka off for Danny Welbeck and go back to a back four, which I think it just shows where the manager's priority lies when it comes to his formation. He feels happiest, he feels safest when his team is playing with a back four. I don't think he trusts a back three sufficiently to stick with it. But I thought the change Welbeck for Xhaka was really odd. I thought that was a very strange substitution.
Yeah, it was. I mean, to be honest with you, this was a game in which I really began to lose track of the shape. Because I think the players did as well, because it was shifting within the game. I couldn't tell at first where Welbeck was supposed to be playing. I'm not sure he necessarily knew. I could see discussions happening between Monreal and Gibbs about who was supposed to be where. Tactically, it came apart. I think the fact that Arsene Wenger in each of the last two games has switched to a back four, I think tells you really what he thinks about the back three. As for the Welbeck switch, I understand leaving a goal scorer on in Olivier Giroud, but I was counting down the minutes till he came off, because this just was not his game. And the longer he stayed on the pitch, it wasn't going to change that.
Yeah, I just don't know why he didn't stick Welbeck on for Gibbs. I mean, what's the big difference there? Get an extra attacker on, keep your shape, and have a go. Like, fuck it, you're 2-0 down. What the fuck? They're all over us anyway. You might as well have a go. But, you know, we just went conservative. I think it made us worse defensively without Xhaka on the pitch. And Xhaka, whether he would have had the chance to provide some service, I don't know, but he's one of the guys, one of maybe two guys in the team who can pick out a pass, who might have been able to stretch the Tottenham defence. But yeah.
Well, and taking him off forced Ozil eventually by the end of the game deeper and deeper and deeper, which is not really the areas you want him to operate in. And I thought tactically the team kind of fell apart. I mean, you know, we've seen that with Arsene Wenger in the past, where it's kind of worked. He's thrown players on and we've managed to produce something sort of out of sheer talent. But as with so much of the season, there just felt like no steering, really. There felt like no real plan for how to get back into the game. At no point did I feel, well, you know, there's a way back into this for us. I had so little optimism and so little hope. And watching that performance, you know, Arsene Wenger, I think, said after the game that we'd sort of dominated the last 15 minutes. It didn't feel like that to me.
Oh, you know, do you know what it felt like to me? I'll tell you exactly what it was. Tottenham were quite happy for us to have the ball because they knew we were going to do fucking nothing with it.
Yeah.
They knew that there was no incision, no real drive, no, what fucking words am I looking for? Penetration. There was nobody making any runs. There was no movement. It was easy for them to defend against us. So they just let us have the ball. And that's as damning an indictment of our football at this moment in time as you can get. Like,
And they can defend. So that is an option for them. And they just, they held us at arm's length.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is pretty humiliating, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well,
it's not our most cheerful one, is it? But then, you know, we can only work with what we're given, guys.
Yeah, that is true. We are slaves to what happens on the pitch. And I mean, where does this leave us? Does it leave us anywhere different than after the Palace game or after the West Brom game? Is it because,
I mean, it only does because of the semi-final. Imagine the mood and the atmosphere now had we not got through at Wembley. I mean, you know, in some ways I'm so thankful for that, because it's the one bit of respite that we've had, and I think that it's the only thing keeping the club from open revolt. I mean, like, on a scale that we've not seen yet. And I think the club are fortunate in a way, because I think the final is going to kind of act as a sticking plaster that's going to protect the manager and the team to an extent until the end of the season, because I don't think supporters are ready to kind of turn their backs on a team who have a final on the horizon.
I agree, and I don't think that should happen. But I do worry seriously that the way we're playing at this moment in time, the lack of confidence, the lack of belief, the lack of any coherent system, the lack of any fluidity to our football, the way these players must be feeling, the way the manager's not able to get anything from the players. And you look at the fixtures that we've got Manchester United on Sunday, we've got to go to Stoke, we've got to go to Southampton.
Southampton in between. I mean, the next three fixtures are very hard. United at home, Southampton away, Stoke away.
I mean,
it's very difficult to approach any of those games with any confidence.
Of course, of course. So I think for the most part, people, of course, will want to be behind the team and be behind the players when it comes to the cup final. They of course they do. But what happens between now and the cup final may have a significant impact on everything else. I mean, I don't think it's a case that even if we lose every game between now and the cup final, people are going to go to the cup final and they're going to support their team. They're going to be behind the team 100% for the 90 minutes. And I think that the build-up to the game will see fans be as supportive as they can be, knowing that this is a chance to win a trophy. But, yeah, I think you're right. If we'd lost the semi-final, I think things would be an awful lot worse now. I think there'd be, I don't know what there'd be, but I don't know what there would be left for anybody at the football club to cling on to. But then we don't know what anybody at the football club thinks anyway, because nobody is saying a word to us. Nobody. Here we are again, and nobody's bothered to say a word.
No. I mean, the funny thing about yesterday's result is that it actually came on a day where other results went in our favour.
Yeah.
I mean, Manchester United dropped points at home, which was a bit of a shock, and then Manchester City to Middlesbrough as well, dropping a couple of points. Do you think the top four is gone now?
Yeah. No chance.
Do you? No chance.
Well, how? I mean, I just don't see where they're going to find what it takes to win the games and get the points that they need. The way they're playing, the way they're being set up, the way they're being coached or managed. I just don't. What can change now that hasn't changed, that we couldn't change 3 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago? Yeah, Arsene Wenger spoke the other week about like how we were devastated because of the Champions League exit. It's like, what? What are you talking about? What? Just fucking get on with it. And you made a point a while ago that he's a man who talks almost exclusively about confidence and belief and mentality and mental strength and the psychological aspect of the game. And I don't think the players believe what they're hearing anymore. I mean, we don't know what he says. We don't know what he says on the training ground, of course. But you can't imagine it's much different from what he talks about in public when he talks at his press conferences or post-game interviews or the interviews he does with Sky before the games. And, you know, we have to have the confidence to play the football that we need to play. You know, we're not quite mentally ready to be able to play that way. And it's like, no, come on. You know,
I mean, when he first started doing it, and it really sort of began happening about 10 years ago, I felt like it was a bit of a, he was attempting a confidence trick, really. He was trying to convince his players that they had this belief and this quality and that they were as good as he needed them to be, because he had a team full of people like Nicholas Bentner and Alex Song and, you know, a team that wasn't really up to scratch, and yet he was kind of imbuing them with this false sense of confidence that helped them get over the line. And I feel like over the years, it's just become a mantra that has really ceased to have any meaning, really. And I think almost probably at the expense of some focus on technical issues or tactical issues or things that could more tangibly improve the team. Now it just washes over you, doesn't it? I mean, I just don't believe. I almost am at the point, I mean, for professional reasons I do, but the press conferences have become almost redundant because he's just trotting out the same stuff that's clearly bollocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that we've learned from anything that he said in recent weeks about why his team are underperforming and why he's unable to get his team to play to the level that he wants them to play at. But I don't think this is something new, though. I think this is something that has been setting in for maybe a couple of seasons, the way that we've been playing. That the inability to operate without Santi Cazorla, for example, becomes a big, huge issue for us. I mean, what one guy can't be that important to the way that we play. Know what I mean?
Well, I mean, he's an exceptional player, but he's almost a player who's so good that he allows you to bypass actual solutions. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's a cheap player. He is a cheap player. He solves problems by his mere brilliance. You know, when every single player who's asked about who the most skillful person on the training ground is, who's the most technically accomplished, and every single Arsenal player without fail says Santi Cazorla, in a squad that includes Mesut Ozil, Alexis Sanchez, you know, people of that ability, you know you've got something pretty special. And ultimately, someone like that will dig you out of holes, but eventually you're going to have to find another way to cope. And we have been completely unable to.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, Arsenal used to be, whether we were winning games or whether we were psychologically a bit brittle. Is it raining there?
It's hail. Hang on, I've just got the window slightly open.
Hailstones?
1 second.
No way.
Hailstones, I know. It's really heavy.
Wow.
Right. It'll still clatter a bit.
Yeah, that's all right. I mean, it's a beautiful day.
It is a miserable day in every respect.
It's beautiful.
Pleased for you.
but what I was going to say was that, like, even, you know, you talked about the teams like Bentner and Aboué and Song and all that kind of stuff. And at least there seemed to be a defiant style with them. That the last two seasons, whatever Arsenal's style has been under Arsene Wenger is gone. I don't know where it is. I don't quite know why it's happened, but he doesn't seem capable of getting his players to play the way he wants them to play.
Well, isn't it tragic in a way that, you know, Arsene Wenger's greatest legacy, it was always talked about how what he'd given Arsenal was this footballing identity and this swagger and this sense of style, and the talk was always that, you know, the next manager would probably have to follow in that footstep. Some coaches wouldn't be suitable because they don't play that type of football. And yet we're looking at teams coached by Arsene Wenger that don't look like Arsene Wenger teams. They don't look like Arsenal teams. And I've read a lot this season about the players and how Arsenal's players just aren't good enough and things like that. And that's just not something I subscribe to, because I remember those teams of the early years at the Emirates Stadium. I remember the teams with Danielson in, you know, that managed to make the top four and flirted with title challenges, but moreover, played with a sense of identity and a sense of adherence to some kind of plan.
Yeah.
And that's gone. Yeah. That is gone now. But, you know, that was a long time ago.
It was. You know, Danielson, a man who was overtaken by a referee at one point.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's it can only come down to one thing and to one man. And that's Arsene Wenger. And, you know, you talk about the players, and I think there's a good case to be made for some of them being moved on this summer, absolutely. But I also think that a new manager might be able to get more from these players.
I think it's more a problem of culture than a problem of ability. And I do think the solution to that probably involves moving people on, because that needs to be shaken up.
Yeah, I mean, you can't say that it's because we don't spend money anymore. It's not the case. That's absolutely and completely not the case. You know, we've smashed our transfer record a few times. You know, Alexis has come in for 35 million. Xhaka, 35 million. Mustafi, 35 million. Mesut Ozil, 42 million. You know, we've spent 12 million on Gabriel, Elneny, Petr Cech, Lucas Perez, £17 million. I can't remember who the fuck else has come in over the last couple of years. But, you know, we have spent a significant amount of money. And it's not because we don't spend money anymore. That was the thing. That was the thing that people held on to. It's because we don't have the resources, because we don't have the ability to compete in the transfer market. But that's not the case. It's not the case.
Well, we're spending more money than Spurs.
A lot more.
Yeah.
We spend less money on wages and or more money on wages and more money on transfers. But they are a team that look like greater than the sum of its parts, I guess you'd say. And we are pretty much the opposite.
Hmm. We are significantly less than some of our parts, certainly this season.
Will we?
I was asked to write a piece about the most painful seasons of Arsene Wenger's reign. Do you think this season is, you know, making a bid for number one thus far?
Maybe, but I think, you know, 2007, 2008 was really painful because we really should have won the league. Last season was painful because I think we had a great chance to win the league.
I think in its own way, yeah.
I think 2013-14, when we started really, really well. Do you remember? I think we lost the opening game against Aston Villa, and then we went on a tremendous winning run. We were top of the table. At the second half of the season, we fell apart. So I think those, for me, have been... Well, again, you know, you look at this one. Maybe it is up there, but I think there are others that are a bit more painful. This one feels like... What does it feel like? It feels like something that you fear is going to happen has finally happened. There feels like an inevitability to this, that there's no way back. There's no putting it right with the current structures.
The trouble is that things like that, sometimes it's like there's inevitability about it. And yeah, I guess things have to get sort of, you have to hit rock bottom before it gets better, you know, it's kind of the adage. But is this rock bottom? Is it going to change? Because that's the concern, right? That as frightening as it is now, looking forward, it's very difficult to be optimistic because, as our friend Ivan would say, that there doesn't seem to be any kind of catalyst for change there. Do you know what I mean?
Catalyst for change. Fuck me. You know, yeah, it's what I said in the blog today, is that the club seems more likely to continue down this same road, the road that we're on at this moment in time, with a manager who can't properly build a team, who can't get his team to play football, who can't motivate his team for a derby, who underperform, who can't win games away from home against the big opposition, who are getting worse. Let's face it, this is probably going to be our worst points total in a long time, after spending more money than we have ever before, over the last number of seasons. This is a team that's in decline, despite what we try and do to it. And the club seems still willing to go down that road and to give him another deal, which is absurd. But the other thing that frightens me is that the people who are supposed to be making these decisions are maybe I'm wrong to call them inept, but, you know, how can you have any confidence in any of them? How can we have any confidence in Ivan Gazidis if Arsene Wenger's contract is not renewed to go out and rebuild the footballing side of this football club? Because he's a lawyer, he dealt with player contracts, he's been in the game, but, like, really, who is there who is going to rebuild? Who is going to come in and say, like, what we need to find is a fucking genius. We need to find some young manager who's an absolute fucking genius, who come in and look at this football club and say, right, we need to overhaul scouting. We need to overhaul the director of football thing. We need to overhaul recruitment. We need to, you know, the guy who's, we need this Dick Law guy. No, let's get someone who could attract players to the club, who won't fucking miss planes and all that kind of stuff. You know, that is what we need. I don't trust Ivan Gazidis or Stan Kroenke or Josh fucking Kroenke to make any of those decisions and to make the right decisions. So while I think we absolutely need a new manager, it's imperative, I think. It's impossible not to be anything other than terrified at the prospect of those people trying to figure out how to solve this fucking mess.
It is scary, but do you think we're at the point where, whilst appointing the perfect guy might be beyond those people, appointing someone who can do a better job maybe isn't that hard?
Maybe. I don't know. Who do they bring in? I just don't know. I don't know. It really depends on who they can bring in.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, the longer it's dragged on, the more difficult it becomes. Mm. Right? I mean, you know, there was all the chat about Allegri. He's now agreed a new deal with Juventus. When you dawdle, options get taken off the table.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Look, I don't know. I really just don't know, and I'm at my wit's end trying to figure any of it out, but I feel like we're heading for a really turbulent time, I think. Whether that's with Arsene Wenger or without Arsene Wenger. I feel like you know.
It doesn't feel it feels very unstable, which is ironic because the idea of keeping us in has been to promote this concept of stability. Mm. But if he stays, it'll be as rocky as anything I can remember.
Maybe that's the option, though. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe we have to appoint a new football manager and see what happens. But that doesn't seem to me like the ideal way to run a fucking football club the size of Arsenal. Let's do it because, well, you know, what else is there? You know, that's this is part of the problem for me, that there is no strategy, there's no plan, there's no future proofing. There doesn't seem to be anybody who has got any real idea how to make this thing happen and happen in the best way.
I agree with that, and I think that, you know, you would love to think there was some kind of long-term planning or strategy underpinning everything at the club. But isn't another criticism of Arsenal's behaviour in recent years that they don't necessarily act with enough ambition? They don't necessarily gamble enough? And isn't this a gamble on behalf of the board that kind of has to be taken, really? And isn't that there a bit of courage and a bit of conviction just in making that decision, at least?
Yeah, maybe that's what we'll see. And maybe we're doing them a disservice, and maybe they'll appoint a great man, and maybe things will turn around, and maybe all the players will start playing together, and maybe we'll win games again, and maybe we'll learn how to defend, and maybe we'll score goals, and maybe we might win the title. Maybe.
It's a big maybe, eh?
It is many, many maybes. Look, I think we better take a little break here and come back and do part two and some questions right after this.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's UnitedHealthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. Part two of the show is where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Facebook page, which is facebook.com/ the Arsblog. And I'm going to say thanks to everyone who's listening. If you've got through that first 45 minutes, it wasn't the most cheery, but hey, as we said, we're slaves to what happens on the pitch. We did the predictions, remember? So just to quickly touch on our predictions, you had Leicester down as a win. I had Leicester down as a draw. So there you go. And Spurs.
Yeah, and then for Spurs, what did we have?
You had draw. I had draw. And then I think I might have foolishly changed it for a win. So
wow.
Yeah.
Feeling optimistic you were at that point.
I don't know what I was thinking there, but
to be honest, even a draw feels optimistic. Nah, I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well, look, there you go. So the next game is Manchester United. And I've predicted a defeat in that game, and you've predicted a draw. So maybe just I'm so terrible at this, I could get it right. But I'm not sure it works that.
Let's hope we're both wrong. But, not particularly confident.
All right.
Should we have a question?
Mm, Why not?
Okay, let's do it. I tell you what, this is a bit cheeky of me. I've pilfered this. So Arsblog columnist Tim Steelman wrote this question on Twitter. He didn't aim it at the Ask Us Dextra, but I'm having it anyway because I thought it was interesting. And he wrote, he said, uncomfortable question. Which current Premier League managers would have done worse with this squad than Arsene this season?
Oh. look, that's really difficult. That's really difficult. I mean, David Moyes, obviously.
everybody's saying David Moyes, and I think we're probably all agreed on that. It's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because it sort of becomes a question of, I think the reason it's interesting, it touches on the idea of, is it about the manager's ability, you know, his kind of sagacity almost, or is it just the case that Arsene and this squad at this point is an unhealthy marriage, you know?
I think that's what it could be. I think that's what it could be. You know, I think there's... I think it's just gone stale. I think that's what it is. You know, new players that come in, they talk about Arsene Wenger and, you know, what his reputation is like and how great it's going to be for them to work under him. But, you know, it's difficult to think of a player that's come in under Arsene Wenger and really improved in the last few years, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
even the young players.
Yeah, exactly.
Your Bellerins, your Iwobis, your guys who show, Coquelin and even, your guys who show a lot of promise in their first few appearances have tended to regress a little, haven't they, the longer they've remained in the team?
Yeah, I mean, you look at somebody like Mesut Ozil, for example, who, when he came to the club, people were dancing in the streets because he was such a talented...
Yeah.
Literally, he was such a talented player. Or a genuinely world-class player, a playmaker with real vision, and I think he's got worse under Arsene Wenger. I don't think he's developed. He's headed into his peak years and declined in terms of the impact he makes. Now, I'm not saying it's just on him. You know, I think when a team is playing well, it's easier for an individual to play well. And the team hasn't played well for such a long time that I think the knock-on effects of that, you know, are part of it. But I don't think that Mesut Ozil has developed as a player under Arsene Wenger the way we would have expected or the way we would have liked. Alexis Sanchez is always going to be a high-impact player, but very much an individualist. That the problems that he had at Barcelona, where they felt he was too wasteful, maybe not smart enough as a player, you were hoping that Arsene Wenger might be able to fix those things, and he hasn't been able to do it. Young players with real talent who've come through the system, you know, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Aaron Ramsey, they haven't developed.
Jack Wilshere. Yeah.
Jack Wilshere. Now, there are other issues, of course, with Jack Wilshere. Theo Walcott. You know, so I can't remember what the point of this question was, but I think that... You know, as a manager, his ability to get more out of players, his ability to coach them and to develop them as footballers, to develop their talents and qualities, I think is very much, very obviously on the wane. And you do wonder maybe if that's part and parcel of the fact that the team itself isn't performing, that he's not getting more out of players. He's not getting that extra 10% or 5% out of players who can then make a difference in a game. In some cases, getting less out of them, and then it's no wonder that we're not winning or that results are poor and performances are poor.
Mm. Yeah. And I think in answer to the question, when you look at the league table, so many coaches probably would have fared better purely based on the fact that it would eradicate that feeling of sterility that exists around the club.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, look, I think that there's a lot of managers at Premier League clubs who are managers of mid-table teams because that's their level. Because maybe they wouldn't be able to deal with a club the size of Arsenal, the pressure at a club like Arsenal. You know, let's not just restrict it to the players. You know, there are other things that are involved when you're managing a football club, when you're managing a football club like Arsenal. But when you look at maybe the top five or six managers, or the managers that are in the top five or six clubs, Like, if you ask me, would we be doing this badly with those players under Pep Guardiola? I don't think there's any way. I think we'd be there or thereabouts, I think.
I mean, I think, look, I don't like saying it, but I think if you give Mauricio Pochettino this Arsenal squad, I think he probably wins the league. At least he'll run Chelsea very, very close. Mm. Very, very close. I mean, it's hypotheticals, isn't it? It's hypotheticals, but it does kind of illustrate, I guess, some of the problems, really. And I think that thing about this being the wrong manager for this squad at this time, I think that's the crux of it, really, isn't it?
I think so. All right, here's a question from Billy Pete, who's at BP_14789. And he wants to know, realistically, if offered 20 million for Olivier Giroud, would you take it? And who else should go this summer?
20 million for Olivier Giroud. Do you know what? Despite being firmly in the camp of not wanting to see Giroud start too many games, I really like having him in the squad because I think he's relatively unique. There aren't that many target men who are as capable as him, so good in the air, and a much better finisher than he's given credit for. I think in his early days he did miss a lot of chances, but last couple of seasons he's been, relatively clinical. So I would want to keep him because I think it's hard to replace him like for like, and I think he does give you that different option. I guess the case for selling him is if you're kind of going to rip up the attacking formula and start again, which we may well have to do this summer, but I kind of think that you're not going to get loads of money for him, and I kind of think, given that he's recently signed a new deal, I'd keep him around. I think he's got a couple more years of effectiveness as that impact sub player. What about you?
Sell him in a fucking heartbeat.
Would you?
Yeah.
Because I know you like him.
Like him. I'm just tired of him now. I'm tired of what he represents in a way. And I agree with you completely. I think he's a better player than he's been given credit for. I don't think he should be a starter. I think the fact that he was our starting striker for 4 years reflects more on the manager and the recruitment at this football club than it does on Olivier Giroud. And he's a solid, if he starts that many games, he'll get you 20 goals a season. And that's not a bad thing. He's a good player. He's a good striker on his day. But I think at this point, he represents something that I no longer want to see at Arsenal. I think he's easy to play against. I think defenders in the Premier League have pretty much got him sussed out. I don't think he's working as hard as he might. I'm not sure he's as happy as he says he is. I don't know why he signed a new deal. I don't know why we gave him a new deal. And if someone came along with £20 million for him, I would absolutely take it. Absolutely. Say thank you very much, Olivier. Mm. You've scored some brilliant goals. Someone will put together a highlight video of all your goals. I don't know how many goals he scored for Arsenal. It must be 80 or 90 goals at this point. Someone will put it together over some dreadful Euro trash dance pop piece of shit that you wouldn't play in the worst nightclub in fucking Magaluf. And we'll go, wow, he scored some fucking good goals, that guy. But I'd still get rid of him.
And watch him sail off into the sunset. I mean, I think it's plausible that he goes. You know, if Marseille are interested, and they do seem to be pursuing a couple of high-profile players in England, they've already took Payet back in January. Mm. I think it's plausible that he goes. I just think I maintain that Arsenal have suffered in the past from not having someone who could come off the bench and be that penalty box player, and I think he's still a decent option. But I don't think he should be anywhere near the starting 11. I would sell him to make sure Arsene Wenger stops starting him.
Well, that's the thing. Isn't the thing that if he's there in the squad, there will be a period where he's starting games and he might be effective for a few games, but ultimately it's sort of everyone knows how you're going to play. You know how to defend against him. Even lower down the league know how to defend against him, unless he does something absolutely wonderful. You know, you think of the Scorpion goal against Crystal Palace. I mean, an amazing, amazing goal, but, you know, a piece of skill that he's not going to do again in his career. So that's the thing. As long as Arsene Wenger is at the club and as long as Olivier Giroud are at the club, there is going to be a period where he's starting games, and that is something that I don't want to see, because I think it's not good for the way that we want to play football.
Oh, I mean, I concur with that. I mean, there was a second part of the question, wasn't there, about, was it who else would go? I mean, where do you start? I mean, the biggest problem we face in terms of the building of our squad is the players that we might lose that we don't want to lose. I think that's, you know, and people talk about top four and, you know, do we want to be in there or not? I do think that probably the most important thing about the top four is that it might enable us to mount a greater case to keep someone like Alexis Sanchez. In terms of players who I think should be shipped out, I mean, he's had a very good season, but if Theo Walcott can score 20 goals and still not really be in the team at this stage of the season, I think that speaks volumes.
Mm.
If the manager still, at the time when he's got his back to the wall, doesn't really find a place for him, I think that could lead to something happening there. I think, obviously, the central midfield needs to be addressed. So I think, you know, they'll be looking at Jack Wilshere, they'll be looking at Aaron Ramsey, they'll be looking at Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and trying to work out who they're going, which basket to put their eggs in. And then after that, you're looking at fringe players, aren't you? I mean, we've talked about Kieran Gibbs. I think his time with the club is surely coming to a close. Cole Jenkinson, Mathieu Debussy. But I don't think it's going to be drastic. I don't think it's going to be like, you know, 10 players out the door or anything like that.
No.
Do you?
No. No, regardless of what happens, it's not going to be that many. But, you know, there are situations where that have to be sorted out in terms of contracts. Wilshere, Gibbs, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Ozil, Sanchez, Chesney. These players have got 1 year left on their contracts. You can talk all you want about, oh, we'll keep them. We'll keep players for the final year of their contract. But that's not the reality of a contract situation when you get to it, you know, at Arsenal or any other club, and particularly at Arsenal, where we have history of selling those players. So,
No, I mean, I have to say, I'm finding it quite maddening, Arsene's line at the moment about, I don't understand why there is discussion about the contracts of Ozil and Alexis have more than 12 months to run. It's like, well, if this Min Azri, Cesc Fabregas, Robin Van Persie, Gael Clichy, so many Alex Song, so many Arsenal players who've been in that position and subsequently sold.
Yeah.
You know, Adebayor, I think, was another one. If that hadn't happened, then maybe he would have a point. But of course, we all know the decision the club really faces this summer is get them to sign or they will go. It's just, there's too much precedent.
Yeah.
On the subject of players, Noah Reich or Reach on Twitter at Noah C. Reach asks, are there any players in our squad who you really love and will look back on fondly in the future?
Yeah, Mertesacker. I love Mertesacker.
And what is it about? Is it the values, I guess, that he carries?
Look, I can identify with him as a relatively slow centre half. I guess that would be the first thing. I just like that at a time where we worry about players being mercenaries or not understanding what it is to be an Arsenal fan, et cetera, you know, I feel like he always got it. You know, he always understood. I think as well, he and Arteta had a big, big impact on this football club when they came in 2011. They were so unbelievably important, and people want to slag off Arteta for going to Manchester City or slag off Arteta for the last season and a half maybe he had where he was injured all the time. But between him and Mertesacker, they had such a big impact. They were so important to steady the ship. And I just like him. I think he's a funny guy. He gets what it means to be an Arsenal player. We don't know quite whether that reflects in, you know, him as Arsenal captain because of his injury. We haven't seen him, which is unfortunate. Beyond that,
maybe Santi Cazorla?
Yes, of course. Of course. That goes without saying. That goes without saying. Santi, yes. I like Hector Bellerin as well. I like Nacho Monreal. But I think the question was love, you know. You know, I don't think they're all assholes or anything. They just annoy the shit out of me.
Yeah.
As a collective.
Yeah.
Some of them individually. But yeah, what about you?
Santi's a good shout, simply because, I mean, he's so lovable in every respect. And I guess also, because his injuries have coincided with our periods of terrible form over the past couple of years, I guess that spared him a little in my eyes. You know, I think I would say that I will look back really fondly at Alexis's time at Arsenal and his performances. As frustrating as he's been in some respects, it's impossible not to love his enthusiasm and his hunger and sure. his sheer ability. Everyone loves a goal scorer as well, you know? Mm. So I felt like it's been a privilege to watch Alexis play for Arsenal at times. But, I mean, I guess the point that the question is kind of implying is that, you know, I think great teams forge those relationships. You know, you look back at players who probably weren't as capable as some of these players, but were involved in title-winning sides in 98 or 2002. They're all squad members in the Invincibles, you know, fringe players, really. I remember so fondly because of what they contributed and because we haven't necessarily had a team with that kind of sustained success or because they've frustrated on so many occasions. You know, Aaron Ramsey is a guy who won the FA Cup for us in 2014, capping a brilliant comeback story from this kid who broke his leg and transformed into this outstanding midfield player and, you know, literally was the hero at Wembley, won the cup. And yet his overriding reputation among Arsenal fans is as a player who is frustrating and, you know, as a kind of an unfulfilled talent. And it's because even the good moments, I guess, have been undercut by so many disappointments.
Mm.
And that's, I suppose, you know, damaged the way certain fans feel about certain players. There are a few in there, but you're right, they're not bad eggs. This isn't a squad full of Bentners and Abues and people who, you know, you think these guys...
They're taking it for granted in a way.
Exactly. I don't feel like that. I feel like there are people in there who apply themselves and who want to do well, but for whatever reason, it's just not happening.
Here's a question from Selbridge Gunnar, who says, is there any way that the Arsenal fan base can make a coordinated protest that the Arsenal board will listen to?
A few questions like this.
There's been quite a lot. Really. Yeah.
Well, we all know what that protest is, and it's a financial one. It's one, I guess it's about not going to games, isn't it? Not renewing season tickets. Mm. I mean, I think that's the only thing. But we've spoken about this so many times. People love going to football matches. Why should they have to not, you know?
Of course. You know, I don't think it's something that you can ever ask of anybody. You know, you can't tell someone not to go and support their football team or go watch a game of football because maybe it's the only thing they've got apart from work and family and kids. It's their, you know, this is their leisure time. When it comes right down to it, it is their leisure time, whether it's driving them fucking mental at the moment. They might question whether or not it's worth it. But, you know, I think that's what it is. I think Sunday is going to be really interesting in terms of how many seats are going to be filled at the Emirates for a game against Manchester United.
Well, I was startled, actually, how many empty seats there were for the Leicester game, simply because we'd won the Cup semi-final at the weekend, and I thought, you know, maybe after that there would be a lot of uptake. But I can't remember a Premier League match with so many empty seats, genuinely.
Mm.
It was striking, and I think maybe that trend will continue. I mean, and this is a big game this weekend. You know, it's a bit of a different kettle of fish. It's not a weeknight. It's a big opponent. It's Jose Mourinho coming to the Emirates Stadium.
Fuck.
By all rights, it should be backed out, you know?
Oh, yeah. I'm dreading that game.
I mean, it's not going to be fun. The one consolation is that Mourinho will probably be content to come and take a point, you know, and he might just set out his stuff for that. He might just be incredibly boring. We might do that thing we do where we're trying to stabilise and we're a bit conservative. It might be incredibly dull. I mean, in a way. What do you think about the concerted fan protest? Because there are so many supporters now who are so dissatisfied and who don't know how best to voice that. And you know, I'm not looking to you and they're not looking to me. But, you know, we don't know, you know, you and I, we don't know what the best course of action is. But what will you do? Is there anything that you would consider doing?
It's a really good question. I don't know. Someone asked me today, is like, how the fuck do you keep doing it? How do you keep writing about it? And I don't, you know, I don't have an answer for that other than it's just what I do. And I, you know, because I'm a little bit detached in a way, I write about the football club, but I do it from distance. So I'm not necessarily there on the ground, I guess you would say.
The front line,
you know, so I don't feel like it's my place to tell anybody what they should and shouldn't do. If people want to protest, they can protest. They don't want to protest, they don't have to. You know, I just don't know what will make any difference. That's the thing. I don't know what is going to make any difference to this board and to the manager. I just feel like fans have been really let down by the club over the last few months, by the football club itself.
It's interesting timing, isn't it? There's the FA Cup final, and then a few days later, there's the season ticket renewal deadline. And it will be so interesting to see how the club behave around that period in terms of how they communicate with fans.
Mm.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, their business is filling that stadium. Their business really is TV, but you know they need that stadium to be full for the reputation of the club, and it'd be interesting to see how they exactly go about doing that for next season. But it's kind of, you know, the renewals I think are a bigger deal than anything that happens this season, because the ticket paid for, you know, the season tickets are all paid for, for the remainder of this season. That money's in the bank for Arsenal, so.
And look,
I don't know how much it can hurt them. I mean,
they're not going to have there's a waiting list. We know there's a waiting list. I think they completely overstate the amount of people that are on that waiting list. I don't think it's as endless or as bottomless as they would like people to believe. Anecdotally, people are being called up from way, way down the list, being told that they may be offered a season ticket, you know? So I think that really is the only... it's the most effective protest is empty seats, people not going. But that's a form of protest where people feel like there's nothing left to them. It's their last resort is to just not go, is to give up, is to stop supporting the club that they've supported for many years. And, you know, that doesn't sit right with me either, that people should be driven to that point.
I mean, the infuriating thing is that it shouldn't need to come to that, should it? The board should have a barometer of feeling among the fans without us having to have an empty stadium when we play Manchester United on Sunday. Mm. You know, it's ludicrous that it's at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, let's say that happens. Let's say, it won't, and I don't necessarily think it should, of course, but let's say there was a concerted effort and people didn't attend a Premier League game. Do you think that would change anything in the direction or the management of the club?
I don't know. I just don't know. How can we know? We don't know what the board are thinking. We don't know what the manager's thinking. We don't know what the owner's thinking. We don't know what the chief executive is thinking, because nobody is telling us anything. Nobody is saying anything. All we can do is judge them by their actions. And so far, their actions have been to fucking sit in their hands, to hide away in the boardroom, pick up $2 million a year for doing what? What exactly? And that's my fear. I mean, I wouldn't say it would go unnoticed. Of course it wouldn't. But when it comes right down to it, what will they do? Some war chest stories, you know, a few signings in the summer. People get excited again. Bit of social media bants and everyone's happy, you know?
Same old, same old.
Same old, same old. So I just don't know. I'd love to say I had the answer. I'd love to say this is something that will work. This will bring about change. This will help make the football club better. But I just don't have any belief that anything will change anything. that decision, that whatever has to change, it has to be a decision made at the top of the club. They don't appear willing or able to do that at this moment in time.
Well, guys, that decision will be made mutually and communicated to us at the appropriate time. Right. Well, look, let's have a question. This is from Mark Nellis. I was interested by this. He said, Mark said, is there anything we could have done differently transfer-wise last summer, or was it already broken beyond repair?
We needed centre-half. We got a centre-half. We needed midfielder. We got a midfielder. We needed a striker. We got a striker. I think what could have been done differently is the timing of the deals, of course. That Mustafi and Perez came in way too late. I think that, you know, had they been able to settle in a bit better, then maybe things would have gone better in that front. But I don't, again, I come back to the belief that it's not about the money that we've spent or money that we will spend in the future. You know, we could go out and spend 90 million, 120 million this summer, and I wouldn't feel confident that the issues that we have as a football team would be fixed.
No, I that's it. I mean, I don't think Mustafi or Xhaka have performed as well as I would have hoped, but I'm not sure to what extent I blame them individually for that.
Yeah.
I think they're probably both wondering what the fuck they've walked into. And as for Lucas Perez, I suppose what I would say is, while I like him and I think he should have been granted more opportunities, if Arsene had doubts about him, then he should have bought someone he had more conviction about. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like if they were out there, which I know is not necessarily easy.
Yeah. Did you see the story? When did we run this story? Let me just get it up here if I can find it. We had it on Arsblog News, and Arsene Wenger was talking about the scouting. He said, we need to improve our scouting. Hang on, let me just see.
Oh, no, I haven't seen this.
Yeah, we have to improve our scouting. He was talking to a French TV channel called SFR.
Ah, yeah.
And here's what he said. Where the fuck is it gone? Okay. He says, I think there are things that won't change. We'll only spend the money we have. We can probably improve the results of younger teams, but also improve our scouting. When you mention Mbappe, maybe we can have him when he's younger. We have to improve in this area because Griezmann, Kante, we could have signed them, but we missed the opportunity to do so, not necessarily because of our financial restrictions, but because we weren't rapid enough. That is something that we must improve, to sign young players before they become stars, because at that moment, all the clubs know them and want to sign them. Isn't that something?
That's interesting, isn't it? That's very interesting. I mean, the Mbappe case fascinating in itself, because rarely do you hear Arsene Wenger be so public about his admiration for a player, and even people close to Arsene, like Robert Pires, are not exactly keeping it a secret that we have been interested and were interested in him. I guess the thing is,
it's his scouting fucking team. You know, there have been issues with the scouting side of our football club for a long time. Not just when we missed on Kante, and not when we missed on Griezmann or missing out on Mbappe. There have been big issues with the scouting side of things for quite a number of years. And Arsene Wenger has the ability and the power to do something about it, or certainly did have the ability to do something about it a long time ago. There was the whole, remember the thing with Juan Mata? When we were about to sign him, and for whatever reason, he turned it down, and there was a big row with one of the scouts, and I don't quite know the ins and outs of it, but it was blamed. There was an issue between the scouting department and the manager. And I think there are also issues within the scouting department itself, that there are maybe factions in there that don't work together as well as they should. Now, Juan Mata signed for Chelsea when? 2001? Let me just have a look.
I think it's later than that.
Not 2001, sorry, 2010, I think.
2011.
That's 6 years ago. There were issues with our scouts then. There have been issues with our scouts ever since. And you cannot now turn around, having ignored the problem for 6 years, and say we need to improve our scouting. These are the sort of things that I think are part of the problem. That people talk about, well, Arsene Wenger, you can't give him a director of football because he wants control over everything. But part of that control is not doing things, is avoiding the confrontations. It's avoiding making difficult decisions. It's avoiding shaking up your coaching staff. When you've got, let's say, a goalkeeping coach who one of our previous goalkeepers absolutely refused to work with, who then went to a different Premier League club and took one of our other goalkeeping coaches with him. That's been a problem for a long time. But again, nothing has been done about it. So this idea that Arsene Wenger, he does have the control, but part of that is manifested in him just not doing anything. By not just avoiding conflict, avoiding difficult decisions because he doesn't like it.
Yeah. And coming back to the original question, I think that the transfer activity last summer, I think if anything shows that, I don't think there is, I think obviously, you know, you can always do better in the transfer market, but I think the fact that we went out and spent so much money and are still experiencing so many problems just underlines that the issues at the club run much deeper than the nature of the signings.
Okay, we're gonna have one more. Yeah, I think one more because we've this is a bit of an epic. So to try and finish on a bit of a positive note, H. Blake Edwards, who's H.B. Edward, at H.B. Edward, wants to know, to touch on happier times, what are both your Arsenal origin stories? How do y'all begin supporting AFC?
Ah, great question. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, so this is a good one. So I come from a lineage of Chelsea fans. It's really unsettling stuff. Mm. And really, that's what I should have been born into. But when I was about, I want to say about 4 years old, my dad, who was a Chelsea fan, took me and my brother to a sports shop to buy us Chelsea shirts. And when we were in the shop, I got very upset and refused to have a Chelsea shirt and insisted that I wanted this red shirt with white sleeves. I was quite into red at the time, and I was really struck by it. It had a cannon on it. It was very, very cool. And I basically would not accept a Chelsea shirt and demanded the red shirt instead. My father, thank the Lord, acquiesced and got me the Arsenal shirt. And from that point on, I've been Arsenal.
Wow. Wow.
So it could have, I mean, thank God it wasn't a Charlton shirt or something like that.
Could have been a lot worse, in fairness, because your brother, of course, is a Chelsea fan, as we know.
To this day. So, but I think as well, having a brother and being in kind of natural competition with them sort of for my entire life, I think having different teams as well probably kind of made me more passionate about Arsenal. Do you know what I mean? There was that inherent rivalry there.
Of course.
That was kind of part of our upbringing too. So yeah, that was pretty cool.
I love the idea of you being 4 years old and I'm really into red at the moment. I'm loving red.
Yeah. It was primarily a fashion choice.
Yeah, I'm going through my red phase.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my interest in kind of sartorial matters has really declined over the next 25 years, as is probably evident. I still like red.
Yeah, thank goodness there wasn't a football shirt made out of grey tracksuit pant material. You'd have been
honestly, if Gabriel Carali had been playing in that age, you know, I would have just supported any team that he represented.
Yeah, well, look, I think mine is based on the fact that I was an Irish boy growing up in England in the 1970s. And I think I've told this story before on a couple of different podcasts, but, you know, we were over there. So when I lived in England, I was a Paddy. When I went to school, even though I didn't sound like a Paddy, I sounded like a good Yorkshire lad because that's where we were living after we moved up from London. I was a Paddy. That was the thing. And we were brought up in that way. Both my folks were from Dublin and we were always brought up as Irish, but living in England. And I think you look for something to connect with, you know. It wasn't in my school. for example, because everybody there was English. We played football and all that in school. But, you know, you look for these things that you can connect with. And during the 1970s, Arsenal had Liam Brady. They had Frank Stapleton. They had who the hell? I'm forgetting names. David O'Leary, of course. David O'Leary. There was Pat Jennings. There was Pat Rice. Sammy Nelson. There was John Devine. Of course, you know, I didn't really see at that point, you know, not being the most politically interested 7-year-old, you know, I didn't really see any big difference between Ireland and Northern Ireland. So they were just, it was just another Irish connection. And Arsenal was absolutely full to the brim of Irish players. And I think that's, I don't remember making a conscious decision to support Arsenal. I don't know quite how it happened, but I just assume that because of these Irish players and me being, you know, a young kid who loved football, living in England, these Irish players made a connection with me. And of course, that was Arsenal. So that's where it came from for me, I think. So there you go.
And what about the mug smasher? How did that happen? Was he just a glory hunter? What happened there?
I really don't know. I don't know, because he's 3 years younger than me. And, of course, he would have been growing up around the same time as Liverpool were winning lots of things. But I don't know how aware he was, for example, you know, as a four-year-old in 1978 or 79 of Liverpool winning the league. I don't quite know how it happened, but it probably was. Yeah, he probably is just a glory hunting bastard.
Yeah.
Who's now paying really for it? He's paying for it now, isn't
exactly.
he? After all those early years of enjoying titles, he hasn't had one for a while. But no, I think again, like you, part of it might have been just to be different from your brother.
Yeah,
to have that thing that you can fight about, or just at least take the piss out of each other over. So I think that's what it was. So there you go. That's how it happened.
Happier times.
And here we are all these years later. Who knew? I mean, James, if we hadn't become Arsenal fans, we never would have met. We wouldn't know of each other's existence. What a strange world that would be.
I know. I mean, you know, in a way, you know, there is a comfort in these long chats we have, isn't there? Record and send out to people. There's something to be derived from that.
There really is. There really is.
So, yeah, I mean, look, I for all that's been, you know, I might have to go and listen to your chat at the end, right, again, remember why it is that I like Arsenal after the weekend.
Oh, gosh. Anyway, look.
I'm just going to go and watch compilations of, you know, Ian Wright goals and, you know, Thierry Henry and things that make you feel warm and fuzzy inside.
Somebody posted a video the other day. It was a Thierry Henry video, and it was like, it wasn't even him scoring goals. It was 11 minutes of Thierry Henry doing skills and tricks and running past players and you know, bamboozling them and great passes. And, oh, fuck, it was great. It was really good. Forget how good he was. You know, you think of him as a goal scorer and that's kind of it. But God, he could do some things. Maybe that's what we all have to do this evening is go and watch a favorite Arsenal compilation and calm down and see what we can sort out before Sunday's game against Manchester United. It's going to be fun.
And Jose Mourinho. God.
Oh, God.
Dear. Well, look, you'll be back with an exciting preview of that, though, soon, right?
I will on Friday. We'll have an Arsecast on Friday, and we'll be here on Monday looking back on whatever the fuck happens there. So let's hope we have something cheerier to talk about than we did today. So as ever, to everyone, thank you for listening. Thanks.
Thanks for sticking with it.
Yeah, we're sorry. We're sorry. We'll catch you on the next
one. I know. Enjoy your compilations, guys. Bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout.
36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.